Thanks again to everyone that's read, helped us open the meeting. I'd take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Huge welcome to any visitors to our meeting this evening, and a massive welcome to any newcomers that might be with us in the room tonight. We hope you're going to hear something that's a welcome, and we hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So we do have a speaker this evening, and I'm going to hand you over to Lisa, who's going to introduce them. So Lisa, over to you.
Steve, hi everyone, I'm an addict and my name is Lisa.
Hello Lisa.
Hi Lisa.
Oh, Lisa. Lisa.
Hello everyone. So I have the great privilege of introducing our speaker this evening. I met this gentleman early in my recovery through a podcast that discusses NA literature, and the first time I heard him speak, I knew that he was someone that I wanted to have in my life. He's honest, funny, kind, loving, generous, so generous. He really does live this program with his entire being, and it's just so inspiring to see. So I am proud and honored to introduce the amazing Paul M, who will share for 40 to 45 minutes or whatever he's comfortable with. So over to you, Paul.
Thank you, Lisa. Hi, everyone. I'm Paul. I'm an addict.
Hi, Paul.
Welcome, Paul. Good
welcome,
to meet you.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa, for that introduction. If you got on after I was talking before we started, I'm half British, so there's always this kind of reticence to hear stuff about yourself that I get from my mother. Nice people don't talk about themselves, you know what I mean? And so I just thank Lisa. She's a beautiful, you know, we have never met in person, and she's like one of my friends in this world. And I know that I could call her at any time, day or night, if something was happening. What a magical world to live in, to be able to contact someone I've never seen in person and know that they would be there for me. That is not how it was when I got to Narcotics Anonymous. If I had something, then I had friends. If I didn't, they were gone. And so if you're new, welcome. This is an opportunity for you to do something completely different that I, when I got here, would have never imagined would be what I wanted. I just wanted to stop hurting and stop hurting others. And I must say this format is a little odd. I don't see anybody, and I'm just kind of in my living room staring out the window at the French Quarter. And just kind of going, okay, I'm just going to talk. I thought about it before I got on, is not being able to see people's reaction is tough. Because I lived my life based on your reaction to me. And look, that wasn't a bad thing. It just stopped working. As a gay kid, I was always reading the room, you know? I was always looking at other people's reaction to me as a protection. And I could tell from how other people reacted to me how to act. Sometimes I deflected violence with humor. Sometimes I deflected it with getting out of the way and not being present. Sometimes I just disappeared into myself. And so here it is. I can't figure out the reaction. And so I'm just going to plod forward and try to be as revealing as possible. So I grew up in Louisiana. I've moved around and lived in other states. I've traveled to the UK, to my mother's home in Harrogate, and to Europe, and I've seen the world. And It doesn't matter where I am. If what's inside is broken, nothing else matters. And you, through the steps and the fellowship, and those two things are important in equal measure, have helped me heal the wounds that I incurred throughout my life. My father was in the army in England during the Cold War, putting up early warning radar stations in case the Russians sent missiles over England towards the United States. And he met my mom. She was pregnant with me in 1959. I was born in 1960. She was pregnant with me, and they moved to the United States, and I was born here. I knew something was different from a very early age. I knew that I liked boys, but knew that it wasn't okay. My parents were good liberals, so I never got a message that being gay was bad. In fact, they asked me a couple of times and I denied it. I finally came out when I was 16, which in 1976 was a pretty, you know, was a political statement at 16. I didn't realize it at the time. I was involved with theater. I was a theater kid, and it was a safe place for me. And I was a Catholic. I was raised Catholic, went to Catholic school all my life, and the church was a safe place for me. I have a lot of friends who call themselves recovering Catholics as well. That was not my case. It was safe. Priests and nuns were in and out of our house, and that was safe. It was outside the church on the playground that was unsafe. And so when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, it felt like it was a playground and it felt a little unsafe. And you said, it's going to be okay. And I didn't believe you at first. And you wanted me to be honest, and I hadn't been honest in a long time. I didn't use too much. I was a big kid, so I guess food and sugar were my first drug. And I think I was hiding some kind of trauma. I was hypersexualized as a child. I have no recollection of childhood sexual abuse, but I was pretty active pretty early, and that's usually a sign. It's not really for me to keep going back and thinking about it too much, but it's something that I think happened at some point. I have no recollection of it. But I knew that the kind of sex that I wanted to have was not something that was okay to talk about. And so I started early with the kind of making the compartmentalization of my life. Over here was this, and over here was that. And a lot of what recovery has been about is to bring all of that back together. And I had a priest friend of mine who said that the rooms to sexuality and spirituality are right next to each other. And if you go into one, you better be prepared to go into the other. They are both ecstatic experiences. And I was like, oh, I don't have to make it shameful and dirty, and I don't have to run away from my spirituality because of my sexuality. And I think, you know, I'm on an 11th step right now. What is one of my purposes in life? And one of my purposes in life is to tell people that God loves us all the time. Whatever that higher power you have, we are loved beings. Not in spite of who we are, but because of who we are. And that message was delivered to me through the steps and through the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. So I kind of dove in head first. I mean, I had been drinking pretty regularly, and you know, blacking out every so often, trying to get home and stuff like that. But I moved to New York to study theater at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And I was very talented. And of course, they would accept me to the Academy. And I got to the Academy. And they said, we don't care if you're talented. This school is filled with talented people. What we want you to do is the work. And the work was to delve deep into who you are as a person and reveal that on stage. Sounds sort of like a meeting sometimes. But I was unable and unwilling to do that. I still had this layer around who I was, and I didn't have a process or an ability to say who I was in private or on a stage. And I didn't get invited back to the Academy. And that summer I got the letter saying, thank you so much, but you are not invited back to the next year of the Academy. And I got high that summer. A friend of mine said, we're gonna do some of this stuff and we're gonna inject it. Would you like to try it? And I didn't want him to think I was a pussy. So I did it. And that was the early 80s, about 1983, and it took off. And look, it was magical that first night. I didn't need a program. I didn't need nothing. The people I were with, they loved me, and I loved them, and the voice in my head that said, you're a piece of shit, and you'll never amount to anything, and you're just a fat faggot, and all of those voices in my heads were quiet. And I was okay. And if I could have stayed okay without the consequences that came along with using, I probably would still be high. And so I'm not one of those people who say my best days using are better than, I don't know. There's some tough days not using. And that was a brilliant day when I first got high. What is absolutely 100% true is that my worst day clean is better than my last day using. And that's why I'm still here. And I know that because I got clean when I was 26 years old in 1988. I walked into my first meeting. It was February the 25th. And I walked into a clubhouse in New Orleans, and it was just before Mardi Gras, and people hugged me, and there was these big burly men come up and hugged me and said, welcome, keep coming back. And I was like, this is a gift from God. I love this place. People are hugging me, and men are hugging me and telling me to keep coming back. I thought, this is great. I'm going to just keep coming back. And I did. And it was two blocks. The clubhouse was two blocks from the parade route for Mardi Gras. And they said, bring your sleeping bag and we'll sleep here at the clubhouse and we'll go to the parades and you'll be able to not get high during Mardi Gras. And I went, that's not going to happen. But I followed their suggestions and I came to the clubhouse and I stayed clean during Mardi Gras. And it was amazing. And I went to campouts, and I ended up in the bayous with boots on, and I'm a city kid. I am not a bayou kid. I'm a city kid. So I'm in the bayous with boots on and a light on my head, and we're looking for crawfish in this mud swamp. And I said, with these fine Cajun boys, and I'm like, this is wonderful. I'm going to do this forever. This is the best thing ever. I'm so excited. And I went to conventions and I went to dances and I stayed clean, going to meetings and holding service positions. And I was great and it was wonderful. And I stayed clean with the fellowship. And the fellowship is marvelous. And if you don't have a fellowship, get one because it'll help you stay clean. Until it doesn't. And I was clean for 3.5 years. And I had kind of worked some steps, but I hadn't really done the necessary deep work. And my parents got divorced. My father, in that time, my father went to prison for embezzling from the IRS. And it was on the newspaper, and the federal agents came into our house, and it was crazy. And my mother was left kind of running his accounting firm, and there was all kinds of stuff, and it was tough. And he was in prison for a little while, and he got out of prison, and their marriage broke up, and they got a divorce. And the first Thanksgiving after the divorce, I went to both houses, and it was just a weird thing. And I was in my 30s at this point. I was just 30. And it was weird. And I had stopped kind of, my sponsor was a pain in the ass. I kind of gotten rid of him, and my sponsees were aggravating, and they need to get someone else. And the meetings were starting to, you know how you people are. You keep sleeping with each other and sharing the same bullshit. And so, and the day after Thanksgiving, an old flame of mine got out of prison, and he said, "You want to meet for lunch?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to meet for lunch." Because, that's what people do. They meet for lunch. And we met for lunch. And he said, "I'm going over to Mark's house." And Mark was a coke dealer. And he said, "I'm going over to Mark's house. You want to come to Mark's house?" And I said, "Oh, I haven't seen Mark. That'd be nice. I'd like to see Mark." And we went to Mark's house, and Mark's doing the same old thing that Mark always does. And Rusty said, "I can't get high. I'm on paper. I can't get high." He said, "But do you want to get high?" And I did. I wanted to get high. And I said, "Yeah, I'll get high." And I thought I would get high, and then I would just go back to my life. And here's the problem with relapse, and I don't think we talk about this enough. There's a couple of things. I thought that after 3.5 years that I would go back to the magic of using, like I did the first time. And I didn't. As soon as I got high, I was back to the last day. I was staring out the window. They were coming in to get me. And all I could think about was, how was I going to get the next one? And it was horrible. And I couldn't stop. And here's the other thing. Once you start, I'm not sure how much control you have of when it ends. I tried for 4 years to get back. I kept coming to meetings every so often, and I would, the noise, the shame and the guilt in my head would be so much louder than what was going on in the meeting that I couldn't stay. And I just couldn't put any time together. I'd maybe get 30 days or something, and then I'd be out. And once you start that cycle again, you have to kind of ride it till it's over. And sometimes that's death. Now, here's the problem with the threat of death for addicts. That doesn't really scare us. I mean, every time I fixed, I was trying to sidle up right next to death. So if you tell me you're going to die from something, I go, "Oh, that sounds like it might be fun." That's why we're adrenaline junkies and stuff. But what I'm most afraid of is not death, but being part of the living dead. And that just that horrible no man's land. And if you think that using sucks, try using after you've been clean. It really sucks, because ignorance is bliss. And once you know there's some other way, it's just not good. So I took 4 years of just keep trying, and finally on January 6th, and you don't know this at the time, On January 6, 1995, I came back into those meetings and y'all were still sleeping with each other. You were still sharing the same bullshit. And the voices in my head were still loud. But all I did was I locked my fingers underneath those damn chairs and kept my ass in that chair for the entire meeting. And I did that, and I kept doing that, and I kept doing that. And everything in my being would say, let's go, let's go, let's get out of here. Come on, don't stay. And I didn't listen, and I just kept staying. I just kept breathing. And eventually, I didn't care who you were sleeping with, and I didn't care that you'd shared that three times this week, and it got okay. And I'll tell you what, I didn't exhale until I celebrated 4 years. I still had that trepidation that it was going to be different, that it was going to be the same, and it wasn't going to be different at 3.5 years. So if you are in any place like that, I can tell you 27 years later that it can be done and you can get through this and you can come back and stay. Because I needed to know that. I need to know that this is, you know, what they said was how it is today will not how it will always be. And I needed to know that. Because when I'm in it, when I'm in that funk, even today, when I'm in the funk, and everyone knows what the funk is, you know those days when everything seems dim. How it is today is not how it will always be. And I need to know it because when you're in that moment, it feels like it will always be like this. I will always be eating the whole fucking cake. I will always be spending too much money. I will always be making bad decisions about relationships. And that's not true. I can get better. And how I do that is the steps, the traditions and the concepts and the spiritual principles contained within. And I all, you know, that's why I said at the beginning, fellowship and program. And I need to have those in balance. If I'm just going to all meetings and never working steps, I am going to the buffet and only eating tomatoes. And if I am working steps all the time and never going to meetings and having a place to practically apply them, I'm still eating tomatoes. By the way, I hate tomatoes. So. I do want to talk a little bit about the steps, because I think they're important. I'm currently on step 11. I am currently working a step and a tradition. I'm working it out of the workbook, and I am working it out of the Guiding Principles book. And I, listen, if you haven't delved into the Guiding Principles book, I love it. I love it. It's a little old school for me, which I like because it makes you look up definitions. And when I first got clean in 88, that's how we work steps. You carried a dictionary and a basic text with you, and you looked up words in the index and in the dictionary, because that's what we did. I mean, that's, you know, we didn't have a workbook back then. So that, and we had these sheets, and look, this is how old school. I remember mimeograph sheets that were like, you know, that was how they had those. They were doing those. And that was weird. I was like, how did we still have this? This is like from the 70s. How did we still have this? They just got passed around by, you know, some old fart had them for years and kept, you know, passing them around. And so we have this new process that has value. And look, somebody asked me, what's the best way to work a step? I said, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Get with somebody. First of all, have a sponsor and do it with them. And the only wrong way to work a step is not. Doesn't matter if you're using this or that, or they told you to write this or that, or I do it with this, or, you know. And look, when I start to work steps, I have to get all the accoutrements. I have to buy the perfect notebook, and I have to have the perfect pen. And it's all bullshit. It's all bullshit. It's stalling tactics is what it is. Oh, no, it's not the right notebook. I can't do this. I don't care if you write it on a cocktail napkin. As long as you're writing, as long as you're doing something, as long as you are making positive steps, you're doing it right. I think that the first, I just kind of want to go through these and my impressions of these. I used to think that powerlessness and unmanageability were the important words in the first step, and they are. But the real kicker in the first step is admitted. To admit is to let someone or something in. And the way we do that is the spiritual principle of honesty. And my mother used to call me a pathological liar. And I was. It was a pathology. It was part of my disease. There's another fellowship that talks about telling the lie when the truth would be sufficient. I had a Rolodex for you young people. That's something we used to use. You flip around and it would give you phone numbers. I had a Rolodex that would have the lie for the subject that was brought up. And the reason I had all that was what was the truth was not enough, right? And that is the word. That's the word that's the kicker here, is enough. We don't understand the concept. Addicts don't get it. And so we are not enough. The world's not enough. The drugs aren't enough. Sex isn't enough. We need all, we have to keep piling and piling and piling on. And it's never enough. And the way to get enough is to be in truth about who I am, what I've done, what happened, and for that to be enough. And it is magical when you take the risk in that first moment to say what happened or what you think or how you feel. And you're met with, I felt like that too. I understand that. You're not alone. We all think like that. I was an only child. I was a gay only child. You can't get more alienating than that. I assumed that I was the only one who ever thought, did some of the things that I thought and did. And then I come to Narcotics Anonymous and I got a whole room full of you freaks. And I was so glad to find you. I was so glad to find you. So admission is the key, letting somebody in. Coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity is about hope for me and being open-minded. And I, like I said, my parents were good liberals, so I assumed I was open-minded. And I have confused tolerance with open-mindedness. I was very tolerant. I have a live and let live kind of attitude. As long as you're doing it my way, and I have a yardstick that I carry around that measures me in relation to the world and the world in relation to me every single moment. And you better do it the way I am measuring, or it's not okay. And I use that yardstick to beat you. And I've, through this process, have learned to put it down. But I still can pick that yardstick up and beat me. And this current set of steps and all of this is about more and more to not use that yardstick on myself. You know, I think that I my process, I don't know about anybody else's, but my process has always been about accepting you so that I can turn that acceptance inward. So that open-mindedness, there's some saying that said all wisdom begins with I don't know. And that's part of the lying that we just talked about, or that I just talked about, is that that lying sometimes would cover up the I don't know. Like somewhere I had this idea that I always had to have an answer. I think, you know, as a gay child, there is always this fear of public humiliation. Kids laughing at you. Kids calling you names, like kids calling you names about your sexuality before you've ever had sex. It's disconcerting. How do people know something that I'm not even aware of yet? And so the lies cover that up. The I know, you know, don't you love that when the sponsor says, when the sponsee says that over and over? I know, I know, I know, I know. And what we want to say is, what we know has gotten us here. It's okay to not know right now. Just trust in the process. Making that decision in the third step is just about moving on. Just about saying, okay, I'll keep doing this. It is not what happens so often in the third step is that it becomes a theological discussion. And here's my take on the steps and theology. It is not, the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous are not about God. They are about the addict. God, my higher power, doesn't need a 12 step. I need one. Now, if you are an atheist, agnostic, whatever, it doesn't matter either. You're an addict. You still need a third step. You need to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to something greater that is loving and caring and greater than you. And for me, that practical application is to move on to the fourth step, keep calling my sponsor, keep going to meetings. And nowhere in there did I say, and you must attend church, because you don't have to. I have to do those first three, however, if I want to stay clean. And I grew up in Catholicism in the 60s, and I was real easy that religion class was over here and biology class was over here, and that I could believe in evolution and I could believe in religion. That has kind of got muddled in the 80s and 90s. But I grew up where these two are completely separate, and I believe in both of them. So I can absolutely work the steps without believing in religion. And I can also be religious and work the steps. And our tent holds all of that. Very nicely, thank you. Fourth step. Ooh, I was in Mississippi at a convention, and I had been writing on my fourth step, and I was sure that I was never getting to a fifth step, because there was stuff in there, sexual stuff that was embarrassing, things that had done, stuff that, illegal stuff, and things that, you know, I just didn't want anybody to know. But, you know, I pressed on. They said, write like you don't, like there's nothing left. No, you know, like there's no fifth step. Okay. So I'm writing, but I'm not getting to the fifth step. And we were in a room. I don't know if y'all know, playing truth or dare, where you pick a truth or you do a dare. And it was late night, and there was a lot of people drinking lots of coffee, and you know how NA people are. So there's, you know, and we're all up and blah, 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 and people are talking. And it got real raw. It got real. It was one of those magical NA moments. And I heard my fourth step come out of other people's mouths. And it gave me the power to know that I wasn't alone and that it was going to be okay. And so that when I got to my fifth step with my sponsor, I was able to tell the truth about what all that stuff and know that I would be loved and cherished and I would be okay. And everybody hates the fourth and fifth steps. I don't know why. Because the sixth and the seventh suck much more. Right? Fourth and fifth is what happened, the past. Six and seven, the present, what is. Eighth and ninth, the future, what could become, right? So six and seven are what is right now. And I tell sponsees that, please do not sit on the sixth step. And you look at the sixth step in the workbook and you think, oh, this is going to be easy. It's not that many questions. And then you get to those five motherfucking questions that you have to write the answer to for every damn character defect. So it's a lie. It looks like it's short. It's a lie. And if you sit on it, you get angrier and angrier, and everybody at work pisses you off, and everybody on the street pisses you off, and everybody in meetings pisses you off, and all your family pisses you off. So if you're on a sixth step, please move forward. And here's the part of the sixth step that I think gets overlooked is removal is my higher power taking care of me. So however that's going to be removed. I have to become entirely ready. And how I become entirely ready is this. Nature abhors a vacuum. If something's removed, what's going to replace it? So I don't have to worry about the removal. I have to worry about the replacement. And it does sound like semantics a little bit to me sometimes. But it is much better for me to not worry about my dishonesty, but to worry about my honesty. I can be in charge of my honesty much better than I can be in charge of my dishonesty. And how I become in charge of that is that I become aware. And in that moment, and we know that moment, where the road splits, Mr. Frost, where the road splits, and I can tell the truth or I can tell the lie. I can take the road less traveled and it has made all the difference. And look, that doesn't mean I'm perfect with it. There's still those moments where I take that well-traveled, dishonest road and I go, oh, fortunately there's a step coming up that will help me with that. But here's the thing, there's still that moment. And I have over time have been able to take that road less traveled. So it has become more traveled. And as you travel it more, it becomes more comfortable. It becomes easier. And it produces something that I never thought, which was joy and serenity. The humility in the seventh step that I want is just to say, please help me with the acting out of my defects. That's for me, that's simple. It's very simple. Now, not easy, but simple. Because I can still act out on all of those character defects, especially if I'm tired or hungry or aggravated or serious or all of those things that can catch us as addicts. When I make the list of people, that's the future now. When I make the list of the people, I included lots of people and I wasn't sure how it was going to happen or even if I wanted to make amends. And the good news is after years and years of doing this process, the lists get smaller and I get to change the trajectory of my relationships. The ninth step for me is not about I'm sorry, but about I've changed. And I don't need, here's what I tell sponsees, because they want to come in and do 1, 8, 12. I have a problem. I'm sorry. Let me tell you about it. And so there are 12 steps and they're in a process. And so when you get to the eighth and ninth step, this should not be a revelation to the people that you are making amends to. They should not be like, oh, they should know that something has changed. Especially the people who love you and who are in your life. And let me tell you, those are the most important amends. Not some one-night stand that I'm looking for on the internet because I think he was kind of hot and I wanted to make amends to him. That's not really going to change the trajectory of my life. What's going to change the trajectory of my life is for all the times that I stole and lied and didn't show up at Christmas for my mother's dinner, that for the last 7 years of her life, she lived with me. I brought her to dialysis. I took care of her. I paid her bills. And I was present in the moment of her death. That's a ninth step. That's the change. And look, I know the difference. My grandmother, who took care of me when both of my parents worked, died, and I was high as a kite for that. And I still regret that. I've come to peace with it, but I still regret my behavior in that at that time. Both of my parents, my father and my mother, have both passed away in my recovery. And they both saw me clean, and I was a living amends in both of their lives, and I am sad to my core that they are gone. But I have zero regrets. That's the power of the steps. And if you say somebody's died and I have not been able to make amends, there's a way to do that in the eighth and ninth step. The 10th step allows me to clean up in real time the times that I make the choices that I referred to earlier. When I take those old character defect paths. And look, sometimes it takes a moment and sometimes it's instantaneous. Oh, I didn't mean to say that. I am so sorry. And sometimes I have to stew on it for a couple of days and go, hey, you want to get some coffee? I need to talk to you. And the forgiveness is not for them. The forgiveness is for me. I have two dear friends who helped me get clean, a lesbian couple. And they were at my father's funeral and they did some shenanigans that I was self-righteously angry about and had a full justification for my anger. I had to make amends because of that self-righteous anger, how I treated them. That's the hardest thing, when you know they were wrong, because forgiveness is not about them. Forgiveness is about putting down the weight that I have carried around about them. I can't afford that. I can't afford that in my recovery. I can't afford that in my health. I can't afford that with anything. I'm on the 11th step. It is where we get the power back that we gave up in the first step. So you don't have to walk around going, I'm powerless. I'm powerless. I can't do it. I'm powerless. I'm powerless. There is a power that comes back. And that power is not self-centered, but higher power-centered. Because I am now searching for what my purpose is. Right? Because of a conscious contact, I am looking for knowledge of his will for us. And the power to carry that out. And when I use the power not to be in my disease, of which I am powerless over, but I am using power to do God's will in my life, that goes much better for me. The last step is about saying yes. Saying yes to life, saying yes to the fellowship, saying yes to Lisa when she calls, saying less, how can you refuse her with that sweet voice? How can you refuse with that sweet voice to not say yes to Lisa? But saying yes to when people want you to be present. People never wanted me to be present. I had people in the dope house going, we're fucked up, but you're really fucked up. You got to get the fuck out of here. And now people say, please, please do this, please. And to take that for granted or to be dismissive of it or to kind of poo-poo it or kind of just kind of go, is a spit in my higher power's face. I have been given this gift. All I can do is share it. And that's every single person on this meeting in our fellowships. Every single person has something to offer. And look, it may not be this, it may not be that. We need people to be at those business meetings. We need people to make the coffee. We need people to stand at that door and hug everybody that comes through the door. We need people to go to the Southern Zonal Forum and vote on our motions. And we need people to count our money. And we need people. There's a place where your purpose can be fulfilled. And look, fit in where you, get in where you fit in, baby. Find it. Find it. Because having purpose is the whole thing. And giving back and being of service to others is why we're here. And look, some days I don't want to do it. I want to be me. And I have to be gently reminded that that's not going to work for you. That selfishness, that self-centeredness is part of my disease. And I'll give myself a day of it, and then I got to wrap it up and say no. So I don't know how any of this went. It's weird not seeing any faces. But I want to thank Lisa again. I want to thank this group. And I do want to say one last thing. I don't know if I mentioned it. In 1989, I found out I was HIV positive, and I was gonna. They told me you have a year to live. This medication, we got one. I don't know. It's been working for some people. It might not work for you. It might. So, started taking the medication, and I ran up my credit cards because you might as well do that if you're gonna die. And here's the problem with that. If you live, you have to pay them back or your credit score will suck. And I lived. And a lot of people I know didn't. And that grief was overwhelming for a while. But through this process of these steps, I have come out the other side. And when I found out in 1989, it was a tough thing to walk into a meeting. In fact, I moved to Pensacola, Florida in that time period. And they said, don't hug him, you'll catch AIDS. In NA, you know, we can still be shitty. And I had 4 years clean. I had enough wherewithal to kind of struggle through and stay connected. And I say this not because, you know, we've moved past all that now. But there is something that everybody in this meeting thinks, I can't say that. I can't tell them that. I'll be rejected. And I'll tell you what we have to remember is that the person who said, don't have him, you'll catch AIDS, was one person. One misinformed person. The fellowship continued to hug me and loved me, not in spite of my diagnosis, but because of my diagnosis. So whatever it is that you think that's going to disqualify you from love, if you share it, exactly the opposite is true. If you take the risk to tell the truth about who or what has happened or what you has or who you are or any of that stuff, we're going to love you, not in spite of it, but because of it. Thanks for letting me share.